This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, sitting in for John Hockenberry today. Thank you so much for listening. Today, President Obama announces a shift in U.S. policy that has loomed in the background of the wars in Syria and Iraq, the unrest in Somalia, and the chaos in Yemen. Federal authorities will no longer threaten families of American hostages with criminal prosecution for trying to pay ransom to rescue their loved ones. The government will also be willing to help family members communicate and negotiate with their captors. That's a level of support that has not existed up to this point.
I knew that the United States government was not going to pay a ransom and did not want anybody to pay a ransom.
That's Nancy Curtis, whose son, Theo Padnos, was held captive by a Syrian terrorist group for 22 months. 9 months into her son's captivity, Nancy learned that he was alive, and his captors wanted $25 million for his release. But the U.S. State Department threatened to prosecute her if she paid. Padnos was eventually released in August of 2014, and there was no money involved. But for the family of journalist Stephen Sotloff, the outcome was not as positive. Sotloff was murdered in September of 2014 by the self-proclaimed Islamic State after being held captive for more than a year.
We never really believed that the administration was doing anything to help us. We had meetings with the administration. The family sat with this National Security Council officials, and basically he bullied and hectored them, and they were scared.
That's Sotloff family spokesman Barak Barfi speaking to CBS in September of last year. Our guest is Amanda Lindhout, and she's author of A House in the Sky. She's a former journalist who was held hostage herself in Somalia for 460 days, beginning in 2008, before her family was eventually forced to pay $600,000 to her captors and another $600,000 to a private security company that helped facilitate her release.
In 2008, I was a 27-year-old freelance journalist who was based in Baghdad, Iraq. And I went on what I thought was going to be a one-week work trip into Somalia with an Australian colleague of mine, Nigel Brennan, an Australian photographer. On our third day in the country, as we were en route to our big story, an internally displaced people's camp where we were going to go and interview people, our vehicle was ambushed on the side of a road by about a dozen teenage criminals holding AK-47s. What followed was 460 days in captivity inside of Somalia, often very brutal and violent times. We were, Nigel and I, finally released after those 15 and a half months when our families had managed to raise enough money to pay a ransom to our kidnappers who were demanding money for our lives. Of course, both Nigel and I came from Canada and Australia, countries whose governments don't pay ransom. So the onus was really on our families at that time to do it. And at the end of 2009, I was released and came back home here to Canada.
Now, of course, Amanda, you are from Canada, but we should mention that Canada still has the prohibition in place. Canadian citizens aren't allowed to pay ransom or fundraise to pay ransom to terrorist groups. Similar rules to here in the United States that appear to be changing. So the rules in Canada, no paying of ransom and no fundraising, even by private citizens, was that a problem that your parents confronted right away, apart from the difficulty of raising, what was the original ask, $3 million?
It was $3 million that they were asking for, and it was extremely stressful and difficult for my family, who were in the position of doing something that was against the law. They were told by the government of Canada that the payment of ransoms could come with a jail sentence. And so they very quietly, for their daughter's life, my life, held fundraisers without getting media attention, and generous Canadian citizens who felt moved by the story gave. But the Canadian government was watching. And what I would say that the government did in my case was essentially turned a blind eye to my family's efforts, but they certainly made them aware of the laws and what was at stake.
We've had similar situations in the United States where the same thing is illegal, but the State Department or the FBI kind of turns a blind eye. They certainly don't help negotiate ransoms on behalf of the government. In your case, what's amazing is that your mother, as I understand it, was thrust into the role of negotiating with your captor. She's not a professional negotiator, at least I don't think so.
No, she's not. My mother was a cashier at a bakery in Canada, making little more than minimum wage when these criminals called demanding this $1.5 million for my life. So my mother was certainly not a professional negotiator, but she was ultimately thrust into the role of becoming one. She was given some guidance by the Government of Canada working with police negotiators to train her and coach her how to speak to the main communications guy from the criminal group that had abducted me, whose name was Adam. My mom would be on the phone with Adam sometimes daily, sometimes multiple times in a day, a very erratic and seemingly deranged man who was always demanding money for my life, often threatening my life. And my mother was forced to deal with this sort of terrorizing activity on a daily basis.
Adam, in his negotiating style, if I can call it that, was also very capricious, right? The price would change day to day. There were threats, something that someone who's not a professional negotiator is ill-equipped to handle.
Yeah, my poor mother had to deal with a lot of really terrible phone calls. There was one point in captivity, as anybody who's read the book that I wrote, A House in the Sky, will have known, the 460 days I spent in Somalia were really very violent. And towards the end of my time in captivity, this man who was the negotiator, Adam, was on the phone with my mother and getting very frustrated that the money wasn't being paid. And he said to her, "You think we're playing games with you? We'll show you games." And 6 hours later, a couple of those teenage boys came into the room that I was being held in and tied me up and tortured me for 3 days. So this man, Adam, who was the negotiator, was a really key figure in allowing the things that happened to me to happen inside of Somalia.
And now back in Canada, you've witnessed, at least on TV, one of the negotiators. Is it Adam who was captured and arrested in Canada just last week?
Yeah, last week on June 12th, Adam was arrested in Ottawa, Canada, and is now in jail there awaiting a trial. So this was a very welcome development for my family and I, who have been over the last 5.5 years since my release really trying to process everything that happened. It's definitely a welcome form of justice, and it was nice to see that the Canadian government and the police here in Canada have been working on this over the last 5.5 years, really diligently working towards creating a more positive outcome for me. They were obviously very limited in what they could do to support myself and my family while I was in captivity, but there was quite a bit they could do on the other side, and to see that they've actually done it and gone through with an arrest is really gratifying for me.
And so it really appears that the U.S. government probably has been influenced to some extent by your terrible experience. The government is not going to start saying that paying ransoms is okay, and certainly the State Department here in the U.S. isn't going to start paying them. I guess we all get that. What does it mean, though, for families to now not have the threat of prosecution, to have some of these rules being changed if they're thrust into the terrible role of trying to negotiate themselves or with a security company, I suppose, for the release of a loved one?
I think this is such an important development. For example, I have been in touch over the last year and a half with Jim Foley's mother, who was herself threatened by the U.S. government as she was trying to raise money and negotiate ransom payment for Jim Foley before his death. And these kind of developments are really going to be critical, I think, because families like my family, like Jim Foley's family, are often in the position of needing to raise the money, needing to negotiate with these people for a family member's life. And when you have the extra burden and stress of having the government say, if you do this, there's a jail sentence, I mean, try telling that to any mother whose daughter is in captivity across the world. It's just not going to happen.
It'll make a big difference for families. And yet you sort of mentioned in your own experience kind of a dual experience with your own government, at least on behalf of your family. One, a threat of prosecution and a blind eye. On the other, in the end, some help with learning how to negotiate, learning what to do. So there seems to be a lot of dissonance in Canada, really, still about how to handle this. Do your American counterparts complain about the same thing?
Yeah, I mean, I will say that when you become kidnapped, you become part of this funny little club. And so I am connected to families and survivors of kidnappings all over the world. And certainly those that I know in the United States every one of the families that I have been in touch with has expressed how difficult it was to work with the government. So I think that this change is really going to be a positive development. And I am very much hoping that the Canadian government takes heed and follows suit.
The Obama administration announcing today that families of hostages held overseas will no longer be threatened with prosecution if they privately negotiate to pay ransom for the release of those hostages. Amanda Lindhout is author of A House in the Sky. She's a former journalist who herself was held hostage in Somalia for 460 days in 2008. Her family negotiated successfully, ultimately, for her release. Amanda, thank you so much for joining us again.
Thanks, Todd.
Later this hour, we're continuing our conversation about the aftermath of the Charleston shooting. Is the Confederate flag the only thing that's changing after last week's shootings? In just a bit, I'll give my thoughts on what's being said and done by our politicians and the news media. But first, we're asking you, is this kind of violence the new normal for America? From Kinross, Michigan, I was involved in a mass shooting at Springfield Mall in 1985. It was simply unheard of at that time. People didn't know how to react at first or even whether or not to believe me when I first told them. I have flashbacks each time I hear of another incident, especially at a school because young people were involved. It feels to me that because the events are so highly publicized, they provide an avenue of recognition or validation for the cause or reasons for the shooter's motive. Maybe if we stop giving their moment in the spotlight or disclosing their agendas, it might persuade copycats from following in their footsteps.
This is Anne from Connecticut. Mixing easy access to guns with an assortment of other issues, mental illness, emotional upheaval, racism, prejudice, and in most cases a desire to be famous, has caused many of these incidents. This sadly is a feature of American culture. Can we change our culture? I believe no one but the police should be able to carry guns, but would that ever happen in America?
Good day. This is Philomena from Westchester. Culture would imply that it's a characteristic that's part of a group, in this case, Americans. However, I would argue that Americans do not want and do not accept what is happening, and therefore it's not part of our culture. Unfortunately, we have to recognize that as to guns, background checks, and the like, which Americans overwhelmingly support, nothing has happened legislatively to bring that about.
This is Judy Merrill Smith, and I live in Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan. You could argue that mass killings have been a part of the culture even before the founding of the nation. Our forefathers saw fit to exterminate Native Americans, and their treatment of slaves and indentured servants led to many, many deaths. Killing the other is deeply embedded in our culture. However, I do not accept it as inevitable that we will always think and behave this way.
We want you to join our conversation. 8778-MY-TAKE is our number. We'll hear more on what's changing and what's not changing after Charleston. That's later on The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program, performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
It's been a week since the murder of 9 African-Americans in Charleston. It was a murder that ignited a debate in this country over race and violence in history. But across politics and the news media, you've been hearing over and over again how the violence in Charleston is, in a word, unthinkable.
Let's not punish 118 million legal gun owners in America,
right?
Because some deranged, crazy, racist, hate-filled person goes out and does something unthinkable.
And the idea that anyone, that any human being, would walk into a church and sit there for an hour and pray with people that he intended to murder is depraved. It's unthinkable.
I'm pissed that after an unthinkable tragedy like the one in South Carolina yesterday, we sit back and wait for the appropriate moment to say what we're all thinking, that this is not the America we want to be living in.
GOP presidential candidates Mike Huckabee, probable candidate Chris Christie, and Democratic presidential hopeful Martin O'Malley, as quoted by Rush Limbaugh, they all find the events of Charleston to be unthinkable. Now, for everything else that they may be, politicians are professional communicators. They choose their words. They calibrate them to tap into emotions. They tune them to make just the right implication. They select them to preserve wiggle room for switching positions later. You know the score. The words of those three politicians you just heard aren't unique. Candidates and office holders from all over the map have characterized the violence in Charleston in the same way. Beyond belief, implausible, again, unthinkable. And the news media has bought in.
Breaking news this morning, get you up to speed on this unthinkable act of violence in a South Carolina church.
9 people killed in an unthinkable crime in Charleston, South Carolina.
He's accused of doing the absolutely unthinkable, spending an hour with a group at Bible study and then murdering 9 of them.
That was NBC and Fox News and CNN. So what are they really saying? Are they just saying it's horrific, that we can't imagine violence so vicious? Sure, something we can't bear to think about, right? But unthinkable does a lot more. It places events outside of our control. Unthinkable means unreachable, ungraspable, not to be understood in this life. And for the politician, it also means don't expect me to really do anything about it. After all, who can be expected to control the unthinkable? After Aurora and Tucson and Newtown and Virginia Tech and Fort Hood and the Washington Navy Yard, is Charleston really unthinkable?
I've had to make statements like this too many times. Communities like this have had to endure tragedies like this too many times.
That was President Obama's rhetoric the morning after the Charleston shooting. Turns out that was the 14th statement he's made on a mass casualty shooting during his presidency. So, not unthinkable at all. How about completely, repeatedly thinkable? And if you're not shocked that politicians would resort to the language of non-responsibility, you should be shocked that the news media provides safe harbor by repeating it. Because the next tragedy is now officially thinkable, like potholes in the springtime or crime on your street or anything else you hold elected officials accountable for. Bet on it, plan on it, demand responsibility. The only thing that's unthinkable is that this week, the week the dead are buried in Charleston, that we believe that folding up a distasteful flag is all that needs to be done. Politicians and too many in my profession are aware the only thing you need to know to find an offensive flag is which way the wind is blowing. Many of you have been making your voices heard.
Yeah, this is Jacob Wolf from Florissant, Missouri. America was born from violence. The Revolution, stealing land from the natives, the Wild Wild West, both World Wars, Prohibition, gangster rap, Vietnam, and a never-ending war in the Middle East. It's time to break the cycle.
This is Debbie from Florida. I will not accept that mass shootings are part of our culture. To do so feels like condoning such actions. I don't think mass murder is inevitable. We must rethink what we are telling ourselves and our society.
This is Justina Ketter. I'm calling from East Meadow, New York. This is absolutely not a necessary part of American life. We can change this. We'd need to completely overhaul the mental health system, and we need stricter gun control laws nationwide. However, if we couldn't manage to fix this problem after Sandy Hook, I have little hope it will be done anytime soon. Perhaps if the next incident happens at the Capitol?
Be part of this conversation. Call us at 8778-MY-TAKE. You can always leave a comment on our website at thetakeaway.org.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org. And Curious.com, committed to helping people learn more than 15,000 skills like Mandarin, mobile app development, and mindfulness. Curious.com. Grow your skills. Learn more at Curious.com/PRI.
However you view it, the transformation of the Confederate flag from a celebrated Southern symbol to one associated with hate and blame has been swift and far-reaching.
The flag will always be a part of the soil of South Carolina. But this is a moment in which we can say that that flag, while an integral part of our past, does not represent the future of our great state.
That's Nikki Haley, the governor of South Carolina. There have been calls to remove the flag from the statehouse grounds in South Carolina, to remove the emblem from the Mississippi flag, from Virginia license plates. eBay, Amazon, Walmart, Sears have also said they're no longer going to sell Confederate merchandise. Ted Kay is a longtime editor of Raven, a journal of vexillology, and author of Good Flag, Bad Flag. And Ted, being a vexillologist makes you a flag expert, right?
That's correct. It's a pleasure to be with you, Todd.
And it's good to have you. Ted, you must be amazed at how the Confederate battle flag, even though it has been controversial for years in this country, has become toxic basically overnight.
It's a very rapid change, and yes, it is surprising.
Why so surprising, and what do you think has precipitated the focus on this symbol in these days?
Well, the fact that the Charleston shooter had posed with a Confederate flag license plate, I think, tied his actions to that symbol. And perhaps this is a tipping point in our nation in our attitude towards that symbol.
How did the Confederate flag get co-opted into the symbol that we understand today? It wasn't always understood with the emotion and with the implications that it has today. How did the transformation take place over the years?
Well, there are two fundamental relationships to the Confederate battle flag. The first is a way to honor the heritage of the South and the Confederate cause. The second, though, is the co-opting of the flag by white supremacist ideologues, which occurred most recently in the 1940s and 50s, beginning with the Dixiecrat Party in 1948. In a sense, the adoption of the Confederate battle flag as a symbol of white supremacy was a response to the budding civil rights movement.
What is it about flags in particular? Look, the Confederate battle flag is not the only flag that has been imbued with a great deal of emotion and meaning outside of the actual, you know, stars and colors on a piece of cloth. People refer to it as fetishism, and I suppose it is fetishism of a kind. What's behind people's attachment to flags in your experience, and what happens when they're changed or taken away?
Well, flags themselves are, by their nature, symbols of places and peoples and nations, and therefore the emotions tied up with those places, peoples, and nations are tied up with the flags themselves. And therefore, people are very tied to their flags and resistant to change about the flags. But this particular flag has these two different strains of connection to them. In a sense, the white supremacist ideology has co-opted the historical use of the flag. It's the United Daughters of the Confederacy that for years have been fighting this kind of co-opting and insisting on the proper use of the Confederate battle flag as the symbol of the Confederate cause and the Confederate history.
Have there been other cases in other countries or other states where the type of attachment to a flag or an attempt to change a flag has brought about such controversy and in some cases vitriol?
Well, it's very common as I see cities, states, and even countries consider changes to their flags that the majority of people tend to want to stay with the old flag, no matter how tainted or poorly designed. But sometimes there are tipping points that lead to changes in flags. Georgia faced that in 2000-2001 and changed its flag, taking the Confederate battle flag off after there was a threat of an NAACP boycott of the state. Sometimes there are good reasons to change flags. Sometimes there are external reasons to change flags. This may be the tipping point for the Confederate battle flag. I think the next battle will be on the flag of the state of Mississippi,
which contains the Confederate battle flag emblem within the larger field.
Correct. And that flag was adopted in 1894. So it's truly a historical flag. Georgia's flag had the Confederate battle flag placed on it in 1956 in a clear and confessed response to the civil rights movement.
Ted Kaye, before we let you go, you know, I've been wondering about sort of an issue around delegitimizing the Confederate battle flag. If attachment to symbols like flags can obscure deeper things, sometimes we call it fetishism or jingoism, it seems like the removal of those flags can do the very same thing, the converse. Is there a concern that removal of the flag from these public places right now obscures doing something on policy grounds that's more substantive?
That may indeed be a concern. My response, though, is removing these flags from public grounds is a very small piece of their broader use by people across the country and certainly in the South to represent both Southern heritage and a challenging ideology.
So maybe more of a deeper meaning than some of us expect in marginalizing the Confederate battle flag. Ted Kaye, the longtime editor of Raven, the Journal of Vexillology, and author of Good Flag, Bad Flag. Thanks, Ted.
Thank you.
Well, a lot of you are still talking about the Confederate battle flag, what it means to our country and what it means to you, and what should be done about it. On Facebook, Robert writes to us, "I am the great-grandson of Major Joel Walker Flood, and my family owned the surrender grounds in Appomattox, Virginia, where the Civil War came to an end and our nation was finally united again. To me, this battle flag is historic in nature and represents those that wanted to divide and destroy our nation for the continuation of these states' rights for slavery as an economic institution. It's beyond time for this flag to be placed into a museum and the lessons learned from all these bloody battles to be studied there and not honored on flagpoles or state house grounds." Al writes to us, "Like all symbols, it has multiple aspects. Most people bring the flag to the flag what they want. The decision as to whether South Carolina should remove it should be left to South Carolina to decide, not politically correct people from elsewhere with little or no understanding of the complexities of the symbol."
This is Derek Smith from Spartanburg, South Carolina. I am what you might call a South Carolinian redneck, and it is my opinion that it's time for the flag to come down.
South Carolinian or not, redneck or not, we always want to hear what you have to say. Join this conversation on Facebook. Tweet us at The Takeaway. You can always call us at 8778-MY-TAKE. And of course, there's much more at our website at thetakeaway.org.
Support for The Takeaway comes from LegalZoom. For over 10 years, working to help Americans navigate the legal system. With assistance on business formations, wills and trusts, trademark registration, and patents. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. Todd Zwillick with you today. If you've seen 2001, A Space Odyssey, the idea of floating in space for months at a time with no privacy, overseen by super intelligent machines like the HAL 9000, it might seem like a nightmare. But for six scientists over the past 8 months, this has kind of been their reality. And that's because up until a week ago, those scientists have all been living under a dormant Hawaiian volcano in an attempt to simulate life on Mars. And if there's been any HAL in this scenario, it's been Dr. Kim Binstead. She's the principal researcher of this study and a professor at the University of Hawaii. Binstead explains how she communicated with her team and how the simulation worked.
We have some video, but mostly we interact with them by email with a 20-minute delay each way to simulate the time it takes for a message to get to and from Mars.
So the point here is to really replicate conditions on Mars as accurately as possible, communicating via email with delay and the whole thing.
Yeah, there's some things we can't simulate, obviously, the atmosphere, the gravity, but we do our best with the things we can simulate.
So Dr. Binstead, I want you to forgive me if my questions are sort of sci-fi based. I don't have a lot of points of reference here for what this must be like for your crew and to be studying them. But I saw some pictures of a white kind of golf ball shaped dome on a Marscape type of volcanic mountain in Hawaii with only mountains in the distance. And I guess the idea here is replication as close to the Martian surface as you can get on Earth.
That's right. We replicate what we can. And Mauna Loa, where the habitat is situated, is very similar to Martian geology. Olympus Mons is a shield volcano, and so is Mauna Loa.
Okay, so the crew is inside the dome. And what are they doing while they're inside? What are you looking for?
We're looking at crew cohesion and performance. So essentially, how crews perform and relate to each other over time and how that affects their performance. We're trying to keep them from killing each other, essentially.
Yeah, and that's part of the question because, again, my sci-fi questions, I'm sorry, my mind is going to a sort of Lost in Space or Robinson Crusoe type of scenario where you might slowly lose it or start to suspect the people around you. What kind of psychology are we looking at here?
Well, we pick very low drama people to be on the cruise, so it's not nearly as exciting as science fiction, but we do see problems come up. So we see issues in communication with mission support. We see some social issues within the crew, and we also see changes in individual psychology over time. So sometimes people get depressed, sometimes people get stressed, particularly if something goes wrong, quote-unquote, back on Earth. And we do our best to support them and to track that over time.
Yeah, so what is a typical cohesion disrupting scenario, if you can give me an example?
Well, for example, someone might get bad news from someone back at home. you know, your dog died, a relative is ill. And that's obviously going to stress the individual crew member, but it's also going to stress the team, because the team then needs to step up and figure out how to help the person out and how to keep everything going.
And the other crew members are trained if something goes wrong with one person, let's say your dog died or there was a disruption back home. How does everyone else help deal with it to keep cohesion solid?
In a number of different ways. So before the mission, one of the things that we get the crew to do is to talk through some of these scenarios and to tell their crew members, one, how it would affect them, and two, how they would hope their crew members would support them. So, you know, some people, when they get stressed, they prefer to be by themselves. Some people like to have people around them to cheer them up and so on. So we get that established ahead of time. Also, mission support is trained to look for some of these problems and to respond accordingly.
Is there any opportunity to be alone inside the environment that you've constructed for them?
Well, they have very, very small bedrooms, and they do have doors that shut. The problem more is auditory privacy. It's very difficult to have a private conversation.
With another crew member or even with a video link or something like that?
Exactly, yeah. And because of the 20-minute delay, the crew can't just pick up the phone and call someone, but they do record video and record audio to send to their friends at home.
You know, Dr. Binset, I'm sorry. I'm just a regular earthling and just a radio guy, and every time you describe what goes on there, my mind goes to sci-fi. You say you can't have a private conversation. Of course I'm thinking 2001, when the crew members had to get away from HAL, so they went inside a pod, only to have their lips read. Sorry for the spoilers, everyone. If you haven't seen it, it's your own problem. So, I mean, that's a problem in sci-fi that sort of presents itself in real life.
Yep, it's true. You know, the crew, they can have a sort of private conversation when they're out on EVA. That stands for extra vehicular activity, and it's NASA E's for going outside. But even then, it's over the radio, and so it's not exactly as private as you might hope.
So it's only been a week. What have you learned about what it's going to take to house humans on Mars for an extended period of time in real conditions? Do they need more space? Do you need a different type of person psychologically than you thought? What have you learned?
Well, we're still going through all the data, so the recommendations I can share right now might seem fairly obvious, but one is you pick people who are already good at handling stress and good at staying cohesive. But you have to also be ready for even the very best people to have problems. Astronauts are notoriously stoic, and they can tough things out. But you can't just tough things out for the 2.5 to 3 years of a Mars mission. You need to be able to respond to problems and be resilient under stress.
So that means that a stoic astronaut or researcher, whoever they are, is going to be tempted to keep their problems to themselves, stick it out, do the job, and that might lead to simmering tensions that aren't good for the mission?
That's exactly right. And so some of the technologies we've been testing on these missions are about how to detect these problems without them being reported. So how do you tell that there's trouble brewing in the crew without asking them?
Is there another group getting ready to go back into another dome? Do you need another experiment?
We are starting a 12-month mission in August, and we are in the process of selecting the crew right now.
There won't be a screening of 2001 ahead of time, I'm sure, since that's my deal. But Dr. Binset, your research is very, very interesting, bringing us another step closer to humans on Mars and what it's going to take psychologically to put us there. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Dr. Kim Binstead is a professor at the University of Hawaii. She's also the principal researcher for the 8-month Mars simulation study that just wrapped up on the volcanic slopes of a Hawaiian mountain. We always want you to join the conversation you hear on the show if you haven't already. You can be part of our listener response network by signing up for our texts. Here's how it works. You get one text per day where we ask a question featured on the next day's show. It's also that your voice becomes part of the on-air conversation. Just text the word START to 69866. That's START to 69866. Messaging and data rates may apply. You can reply STOP to opt out. And of course, you can always call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or comment on anything you hear on today's program at thetakeaway.org. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. John is back tomorrow. This is The Takeaway.